Israeli forces raid a refugee camp in the West Bank city of Tokhan. EU leaders approve 1 billion euros in new military aid for Ukraine. And people protest in New York to condemn chokehold killing of an African-American man by a white former Marine. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumisha Ahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. In the occupied West Bank, a funeral procession has been held for two young Palestinians killed by Israeli forces on Saturday morning. The two Palestinians, both in their 20s, were fatally shot during the regime's raid on a refugee camp in the city of Tulkarm. According to local sources, Israeli troops clashed with Palestinians at the camp. They also prevented medics from reaching the injured. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has reacted, saying that the Israeli crime will not go unanswered. The latest violence raises to 110, the total number of Palestinians killed by the regime so far this year. Around 20 of the victims are under 18 years old. Saturday's killings come amid rising tensions in the occupied territories, where Israel has stepped up its crackdown against Palestinians. For more on that, we're joined by our correspondent Mona Kandel, joining us live from Ramallah. Also, Adel Samara, political commentator, will be with us to discuss that further. But first, let's bring in our correspondent, Mona Kandel, for more details. Mona, tell us more. I know that it was a day of mourning already with the bodies of three Palestinians that were killed nearly 2 months ago, and their bodies were just received by their families. And we had just received that news when we received some more tragic news that two other Palestinians were also killed in another raid.
That's right. The three Palestinians were killed by forces over 25 days ago. The Israeli military returned back the bodies of three Palestinians in Nablus after 55 days of holding their bodies. And as you have said, 1,000 Palestinians took apart in the funeral processions that took place in Nablus for Uday al-Shami, Jihad al-Shami, and Mohammed Abik. The three of them received a huge funeral, and thousands of Palestinians took part in this funeral procession. Unfortunately, today morning, the Israeli forces raided the refugee camp of Nur al-Shams in Tulkarm. The two Palestinians who were killed by the Israelis, as you have said, two Palestinians were shot dead. They were 22 years old, of course, both of them. The Israelis claimed that those two Palestinians, Hamza Khariouj and Samer al-Shafi'i, were responsible for a shooting that took place at one of the illegal Israeli settlements near Tulkarm and led to the injury of one Israeli settler several days ago. The Israeli military claimed the operation meant to arrest Palestinians whom they accused them of being responsible for the shooting. Clashes took place between the young Palestinians and the Israeli soldiers. Those two Palestinians were shot and wounded, and the footage coming out from Nur al-Shams refugee camp showed clearly those Palestinians on the top of a building, on the roof of the building, with Israeli soldiers around them. They didn't allow anyone to rescue their lives. They left them bleeding until they passed away. During this operation, two more Palestinians were arrested by the Israeli forces, and the funeral procession of the two young Palestinians is taking place in Tul Karim now, with thousands of Palestinians vowing to avenge the killing of those two young Palestinians, and saying that the only option that is left for the Palestinians is the resistance, with the non-stop Israeli crimes against Palestinians. It's a natural response for the Palestinians to resist and fight the Israeli forces to defend themselves, to defend their families, as well as their homes and land.
So, Mona, we don't have Adel Samara with us, so I'm going to ask you this question. What is the reason behind the Israeli regime not allowing Palestinians to hold funerals for their loved ones, or taking so long to give them the bodies of the deceased back?
The Israeli military thinks that by holding the body of martyrs, they would be punishing the families of those Palestinian martyrs, and that they would be sending a message to the family that if your sons would be carrying out any anti-Israeli operations and being killed during these operations, then their bodies would be held. It's a part of a collective punishment. It's part of Israeli military procedures to send a message that anyone would be resisting the Israeli military, then they would not receive the funeral procession or appropriate burial, as the Palestinians or as Muslims should receive an appropriate burial. So they try to keep the bodies of Palestinians, mainly those who at the end of the day are found, like the Israelis say, that they killed Israeli soldiers or settlers, or they were shot dead during anti-Israeli operations. Maybe after months, the Israeli military would return back the bodies. For Palestinians being killed in Al-Quds specifically, Palestinians, as the Israelis say, blood on their hands, the Israeli regime condition that only few people are allowed to take part in the funeral procession, only dozens and maybe less, and family members as well, and that funeral procession must take place at night. So it's a collective punishment. Israel still holds of dozens of in their mortuaries, with hundreds also had been buried in the so-called graveyards of numbers, or the numbers graveyards. The families that don't know where their sons had been buried. It's also a collective punishment as well.
Thank you very much. That was our correspondent, Mona Kandel, joining us live from Ramallah. Moving on, Iran has executed the ringleader of a terrorist group who was behind numerous attacks in the country. Habib Fazlullah Chaab, nicknamed Habib Asyud, was the leader of the Harakat al-Nidal terror group. He had masterminded several terrorist attacks in Iran, including the one on a military parade in the southwestern city of Ahvaz back in 2018. Dozens of people were killed or wounded in the attack. He was running the terrorist group under the supervision of several foreign spy agencies, including the Israeli regime's Mossad. Harakat al-Nidal is a terrorist and secessionist group which focuses its operations in Iran's southwestern Khuzestan province in a bid to create insecurity there and finally to separate it from the country. EU leaders sign off a 1 billion euro ammunition package for Ukraine on Friday, despite growing financial hardship for citizens throughout the 27-nation bloc. A seventh consecutive hike in interest rates has been confirmed by the European Central Bank. Jerm Hughes reports.
Millions of struggling homeowners with tracker mortgages will soon start paying back even more following a decision by the European Central Bank to increase interest rates by a quarter of 1%.
We have covered a lot of ground in the last 9 months, right? Moving from minus 50 basis points to plus 300 basis points. We are continuing this hiking process.
Rents are going up as landlords with mortgages pass on the costs. The aim is to bring down inflation, but disgruntled unions insist the strategy won't work. It's all linked to energy sanctions against Russia. EU citizens are being financially pummeled. However, the bloc's leaders have just agreed on a huge additional package to arm Ukraine.
So we are talking about 1 billion capacity to upscale our industrial base.
Ordinary people don't see an end in sight to the crippling cost of living crisis.
A person who is employed, he can survive, but just think about a person who is not employed, how it is impacting him.
If we don't have also like kind of a push on the wages, we will not be able to cope with that, and our reserves, our savings, we will go down.
Analysts suggest peace in Ukraine is the answer, but EU authorities say Kiev will be supplied with deadly weapons for as long as it takes.
It is for Ukraine, that is the country that has been attacked, to decide in which conditions it is ready to find peace with Russia.
Employment ministers have been assessing pressures on EU businesses due to high inflation and interest rates. Firms are also struggling to find skilled workers.
26% of companies all over Europe consider that labour shortage are a major difficulty for them.
Economists say because EU leaders have cut off cheap gas and oil flows from Russia, winter 2023 will tell us all we need to know about the bloc's resilience or lack thereof. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The coronation of King Charles III has got underway in Britain amid a cost of living crisis in the country and recent nationwide strikes over pay. People in the UK are questioning the costly pomp and pageantry associated with the state-funded ceremony. The recent survey shows most of the British people want the coronation to be funded by the royal family itself. Estimates put the cost of the coronation as high as $130 million. Anti-monarchy activists say the cost is a slap in the face of millions of people who are struggling to meet their daily expenses. They say the coronation is a celebration of hereditary power and has no place in modern society. Meanwhile, six members of an anti-monarchy group have been arrested ahead of the coronation ceremony. A new report has accused French police of illegal arrest tactics during the ongoing demonstrations against an austerity rollback to their pension system. And it's just the latest in a long-running series of allegations which have earned French police the moniker of the most brutal in Europe. Ramin Mazahiri has more.
France's chief inspector of prisons has issued a damning report on the use of illegal arrest tactics against protesters by French police. It appears like the latest proof that the right to demonstrate in France isn't as free as their leaders claim. The report said police management encouraged the use of arbitrary, indiscriminate, and even preventative arrests of demonstrators who had committed no crime. The study found convincing proof for their allegations. Only 20% of nearly 1,000 arrests during just 1 week of anti-pension hike demonstrations in March actually resulted in charges being brought.
C'est très, très, très inquiétant.
It's very, very worrying because we have the impression that our police are totally out of control. They have incredible judicial latitude to make arrests, and then they are also using weapons which are truly arms designed for war. The climate of violence which police create at protests is really a problem for us.
The European Court of Human Rights has condemned full abuses by French police 5 times in the past 6 years, and the coronavirus paused demonstrations for a year and a half during that era. French police are the most heavily armed, among the least trusted, and among the least popular of any cops in Europe.
Nobody has confidence in the police here. They're overarmed to a scandalous degree. I hope our police are considered the shame of Europe, because that is entirely the case. I'm a government worker, so I have nothing against the state. But the situation is incredibly pathetic.
France has repeatedly not participated in pan-European Union de-escalation police training. This week's International Workers' Day march saw mass indiscriminate arrests and violent tactics. Protesters knew this was coming and turned out by the millions anyway. Many may recall back in 2019 that the Yellow Vest protests only tailed off following 6 months of weekly police brutality, which scared the average person away from political demonstrations. France knows it has an infamous problem with police brutality, but their elites still seem uninterested in finding democratic solutions. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Another protest is held in the U.S. over the death of a black man who was killed by a white former Marine in New York. The protesters chanted justice for Jordan as they gathered outside the Manhattan District Attorney's office on Friday. They called Neely's death an act of a lynching, linking it to the murder of George Floyd by white officers in 2020. Neely, a mentally ill homeless man, died on Monday. A video circulating on social media shows a former Marine holding him in a chokehold before he faints and later dies in hospital. The New York Medical Examiner has called his death a homicide. However, the Manhattan District Attorney has refrained from announcing any charges against the Marine involved in his death. Sudan's army says that it has sent a delegation to Saudi Arabia for a planned truce talks with the Revival Rapid Support Forces as fighting persists in the African country. The army says that the aim is the extension of the current ceasefire agreed with the RSP. This is while the warring sides earlier said that talks in Jeddah will only focus on a humanitarian ceasefire. They said that they will not discuss ending the war. The army and the RSP are fighting a battle for the control of the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. Multiple ceasefires have been agreed since the fighting erupted on April 15th, but none of them have been respected. The conflict has so far killed hundreds of people and displaced 100,000 others. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Salutations to the immortal saints of Ray. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, dear listeners, and welcome to a special program on the occasion of the passing away of a special person, whose holy shrine in Ray, which is an important site of pilgrimage, makes him the prime saint of the Iranian capital, Tehran, to the extent that people call him Shah or King. In fact, the spiritual king who continues to govern hearts and souls. Stay tuned, please. Peace unto the virtuous and obedient slave of Allah, the Lord of the universe, of his messenger, the Prophet of Islam, and the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him. Peace unto you, O Abul Qasim, the offspring of the Prophet's noble grandson, Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him. Peace upon you, Ziyarat, or visitation to whose shrine has the reward of the Ziyarat, to the shrine of the Chief of Martyrs, Imam Hussein. It is obvious we are not saluting any ordinary person. The above passages indicate that our salutation is to a dignified member of the blessed progeny of the Almighty's last and greatest emissary to mankind with the universal message of Islam. To be more precise, these are among the passages that tens of thousands of pilgrims are reciting today on Shawwal 15th. In fact, since last night, while visiting the shrine of this virtuous person in what was once the historical city of Ray, now a southern suburb of Tehran, commemorate the anniversary of his departure from the mortal world. Based on the fourth month of Rabiul Akhir, in the Prophet's city, Medina, in the year 1173 AH, he was fifth in descent from Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him, and was named Abdul Azim. He grew up into a scholar of repute and had the honor of companionship of three of the Prophet's 12 divinely designated infallible heirs, Imam Ali Reza, Imam Muhammad Taqi al-Jawad, and Imam Ali al-Naqi al-Hadi, peace upon them. He is among the early erudite scholars who collected, in book form, several eloquently wise sermons of the gateway of the city of knowledge, Imam Ali, peace upon him, and titled it Khutab Amirul Mu'minin, 150 years before Sayyid Razi was to compile the famous book Nahjul Balagha and include many of them in it. He was, however, not an armchair scholar, but an active missionary for spreading in society the genuine teachings of Islam, especially in Iran, where he settled in those days of severe persecution of the followers of the Ahlul Bayt by Mutawakkil, that most infidel ruler of the usurper Abbasid dynasty of self-styled caliphs. No wonder his services to humanity and the continued homage being paid to him for the past millennium and two centuries by the grateful people of Iran, who reverently address him as Shah or King, though he did not possess any kingdom, but has continued to rule the hearts of believers throughout the world for the past millennium and two centuries. This is testimony to one of the famous sayings of his illustrious ancestor, the Prophet's vicegerent, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him. Those who amass wealth are actually dead, even though they may be living, while those endowed with knowledge will remain as long as the world exists. This wonderful aphorism means that the truly knowledgeable scholars are alive in the hearts of the faithful, even though they are not physically present in our midst. According to the famous Iranian scholar Sheikh Saduq, who lived 1,000 years ago, once Abdul Azim asked Imam Ali al-Naqi al-Hadi, peace upon him, the Prophet's 10th infallible heir, peace upon him. O son of Allah's Messenger, I wish to present to you my beliefs. If they are correct, then I will affirm and adhere to them till I meet Allah, the Great and the Exalted. I affirm Allah, blessed and exalted, is one. There is nothing like Him. He is beyond the two limits, that is, the limit of negation and annulment of attributes, and the limit of anthropomorphism. And He has neither a body nor a form, nor dimension, nor a material core. Rather, He is the one who creates bodies and gives forms, the creator of dimensions and matter, lord of everything and its possessor, creator and originator. And I affirm Muhammad is His servant, His messenger, and the seal of prophets. There is no prophet after Him till the day of judgment. And I affirm after Him the Imam, the Caliph, and the guardian of the affair of guidance is Amirul Mu'minin Ali ibn Abi Talib, and then Hassan, then Hussein, then Ali ibn al-Hussein Zainul Abidin, then Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, then Ja'far ibn Muhammad al-Sadiq, then Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim, then Ali ibn Musa al-Riza, then Muhammad ibn Ali al-Taqi al-Jawad, and thereafter, you, my master. Imam Hadi, peace upon him, nodded in the affirmative and elaborated, "And after me will be my son, Al-Hassan al-Askari. However, I wonder how the people will react with regards to his successor." Abdul Azim says, "I asked, 'Why do you say that, O Master?' The 10th Imam replied, 'Because none will see his person during the long period of occultation, nor will it be permissible to mention his name till he reappears to fill the earth with justice and equity as it was previously filled with oppression and tyranny.'" Abdul Azim narrates, "So I responded, I accept what you have informed me, and I maintain that their friend is the friend of Allah. Their enemy is the enemy of Allah. Obedience to them is obedient to Allah. Disobedience to them is disobedience to Allah. I maintain that the Prophet's Mi'raj, or ascension to the highest point in the heavens and back to planet Earth in a fraction of a night, did occur. That questioning in the grave will happen, that heaven and hell exist, that accounting of deeds will occur, and that the hour will undoubtedly arrive when Allah will resurrect those in the graves. I further maintain that the religious obligations after velayat, love and adherence to the Ahlul Bayt, are the ritual prayers, the zakat levy, fasting in the month of Ramadan, Hajj, pilgrimage to the symbolic house of God, the holy Kaaba in Mecca, jihad, striving in the path of Allah, enjoining good, amr bi ma'ruf, and discouraging evil, nahy anil munkar. On hearing this, the 10th Imam said, O Abul Qasim, by Allah, what you have mentioned is the religion which Allah has chosen for your servants and one with which He is satisfied. So adhere to it. May Allah keep you steadfast on the established faith in this world and in the hereafter. Sheikh Saduq, who compiled the book on Sayyid Abdul Azim titled Jame Akhbar Abd al-Azim, has narrated that a man from Ray came to Imam Hadi, peace upon him, in Samarra in Iraq in those days of severe persecution of the followers of Ahlul Bayt and said, I have visited the holy shrine of Imam Hussein, peace upon him. The Imam replied, if one visits Abdul Azim al-Hassani's tomb near you, it would be as if he has visited Imam Hussein, peace upon him, in Karbala. Let us join the multitude of pilgrims streaming to the sprawling golden domed shrine in Ray for a worthy salutation to the prime saint of Tehran by saying, Peace unto you. May Allah grant us your companionship in paradise. Gather us in your company. Guide us to your prophet's fountain and make us drink of your ancestors' cup through the hand of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Israeli regime forces atrocities continue in the occupied territories. In the latest episode, three Palestinians were killed and four injured during a raid on the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. This comes days after the murder of a senior leader of the Islamic Jihad movement, Khadr Adnan, who embraced martyrdom at an Israeli jail. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the continuing atrocities committed by Israeli regime forces while looking at some of the statements made by Iran's president to Palestinian resistance leaders during his landmark visit to Syria. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the program. Ramzi Barood, historian and author, joins us from Seattle, Washington. Also joining us, Syed Nimr, professor of political science at Birzeit University, who joins us from occupied Ramallah. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Ramzi Barood, I'll start with you. Just taking a look at what has occurred over here in this one incident in occupied Nablus. We're looking at three Palestinians who have been injured three killed, four injured during this raid. What is alarming about this, based on the Palestinian Health Ministry, who said two of the martyrs were completely distorted in terms of their features due to the intensity of the shooting. I'm wondering what you think about these raids that are continuing, because one of the premonitions or one of the statements coming out of the Israeli regime forces is that they are killing based on them being suspects or that they may commit crimes in their eyes, which doesn't make sense as to using that as an approach to either detain or kill Palestinians.
Right. So I first of all, thank you very much for having me on your program. And I think it's very important that we keep in mind the larger context of the killing of the three Palestinian fighters in the old city of Nablus today. And we also have to mention that a fourth Palestinian, a woman, was killed near Hawara as well in the West Bank. The context of this is what has been taking place in Gaza, and earlier the death or the deliberate really killing of Adnan Khadr, Sheikh Khadr, in Israeli prisons. Israel has been trying to send a message to the Palestinians, especially Netanyahu's government, that its so-called deterrence is not has not been weakened in recent months. We know that this debate has been happening in Israel among Israeli politicians. The Israeli oppositions have been accusing Netanyahu of weakening Israel's deterrence, allowing the Palestinian resistance to grow and to operate, whether in Gaza or in the West Bank. Following Sheikh Khadr's death a couple of days ago, what took place in Gaza indicated that indeed the resistance in Gaza is not only strong or as strong, but in fact stronger. That can be argued based on how the immediacy of their response to the killing of the Sheikh, and also to the coordinations that happened between the various Palestinian parties, Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, to be more specific. Israel has kind of perhaps was betting on some sort of a division within the Palestinian resistance in Gaza. What has taken place in the last couple of days indicate that this has not happened yet, and hopefully it won't. So the attack on Nablus, the killing of the three Palestinians in Nablus, was Netanyahu's message to the Israeli opposition that our deterrence is still strong, and also to Itamar Ben-Gvir, this fascist, far-right Israeli politician, the Minister of National Security, or so-called National Security, that has been quite upset with Netanyahu for not attacking Palestinians with greater ferocity in Gaza in the last 48 hours. So he was trying to say, no, we are still strong, the deterrence is still strong, and so forth. In my opinion, however, these are desperate acts. Clearly, the Palestinian resistance is stronger than ever before, and the equation between the resistance and Israel has fundamentally, and I think irreversibly, changed in recent months and years, particularly since the events of May 2021. No matter what Israel does, no matter the kind of hideous crimes that they are committing, like the ones that they have committed in Nablus and Hawara today, the time is not going to go back.
Sure.
And the equation has indeed been irreversible and unchanged.
Well, it's that number. Our guests there just said that the equation has changed, and along with that, based on the killings that took place today, three of them in Nablus, and also prior to that, he did rightly so mention about the Palestinian woman who was killed, that this is a message from Netanyahu that the deterrence is strong. Isn't that kind of a sorry and sad state of affairs when you have the Zionist regime subscribe to killing Palestinians in order to send a message that its deterrence is strong? And is it sending that message?
It's quite obvious to us that there is two issues here we have to address regarding what happened today, this morning in Nablus. One of them is, as your guest Ramzi said, that it is a kind of a message by Netanyahu to his alliances in the government, since there was lots of criticism to Netanyahu's government after the events in Gaza. Gaza, they sent more than 100 rockets at night after the death of Sheikh Khadr Adnan in the prison after his strike. That was, you know, met by the Israelis, some of the, you know, bombings of Gaza, which from the Israeli point of view, or some of the opposition and even parts of the government, that was not enough and that was not adequate. And the answer or the retaliation by the Israeli was so weak. So definitely, on the other hand, the government and Netanyahu would like to do some other, you know, shows to say that, no, we are, you know, going ahead in fighting against the Palestinians, especially the resistance in the West Bank. But on the other hand, there is another issue here, which we have to understand quite well, that this is an Israeli policy which is continuing since, you know, last year or even before last year, and it's going on a steady way. The aim is to end the Palestinian resistance in Jenin and in Ramah, in Nablus, as well as in Jericho. Jericho now for 13 days been under siege, and also the day before yesterday they were inside Aqaba Jabr, a refugee camp, and they were trying to get, because there were some group of also resistance growing in Aqaba Jabr. And if you remember, in many occasions we said that this phenomena of Palestinian resistance is growing, and it's growing steadily, slowly but steadily, and definitely, surely, it's going to be all over the West Bank. And the Israeli are really mad of this phenomena, and they want to end it. So we are talking about two issues here. The first issue is, you know, retaliation and a kind of, you know, statement by Netanyahu. But at the same time, this is a continuation of this policy of ending the Palestinian resistance. We believe that the Palestinian resistance now is growing, well, not yet reached the moment, okay, of being, you know, strong enough, but at the same time it's growing, and it's what we think that our hopes are really great for it.
Sure.
I believe that we are, the last statement, I believe that we are on the verge of the end of the whole situation, especially that we are talking about, you know, Lebanon, we are talking about Syria, we are talking about Iran, we are talking about Gaza, and we are talking about the West Bank. This kind of alliance in general, I think it will come soon. And Israel is pushing itself and pushing the Palestinians and pushing the whole area into really a final episode.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that alliance that you just mentioned a little later. Before that, let's go along those lines, Ramzi Baroud, where we're seeing report after report, whether it's through the media or what have you, that Israel is looking rather weak. It was pretty evident when there was some rockets that were fired from southern Lebanon, and there were reports that Israel actually retaliated, but it was onto open fields. It didn't go after bombing southern Lebanon. Later it turned out that Hamas took responsibility. And Israel came out and said, we're alarmed by resistance groups now in southern Lebanon, because it gave the feeling that Israel feels like it's encircled, which in a sense it is. If you take a look at it from Gaza Strip to Lebanon to Syria, and of course if it dares to cross the red line when it comes to Iran. Is that why it's rather reluctant to get engaged any military incursions of any kind at this point in time with any of these resistance groups?
Absolutely. I think in order for us to understand what is transpiring now, we have to compare it to what was the status quo in the past. Let's remember what happened in Gaza in 2008-09, when Israel attacked Gaza with ferocity, killing thousands of people. And I do remember it was, I think, Tzipi Livni, she was kind of an acting prime minister at the time, and she, when she was asked about the disproportionate response to Palestinian rockets, she answered with something to the effect of, you know, we want to send a message to the Palestinians that if we get attacked, we go crazy, something of that nature. Now, those years and those days are behind us now. This idea that Israel determines the time and place of the battle against Palestinian resistance and uses violence as a way to achieve political ends in Israel itself, and to do what they call mowing the grass, meaning that kind of keeping the Palestinian resistance at a very low primitive level of in terms of infrastructure and capabilities, those years are behind us. In the last few days, we have been seeing Palestinian resistance fighters using surface-to-air missiles, using the kind of technology that would have been unthinkable in the first Israeli war on Gaza in 2008 and 2009. And Israel is no longer able to achieve political ends at home. To the contrary, engaging with Palestinians in the military field will always cause Israeli politicians in terms of weakening their hold on their usually far-right constituency in Israel. But something else has happened, and it's quite dramatic, and that is the fact that Lebanon is back, the fact that the Syria war has been kind of largely marginalized. It's not as it used to be in terms of the intensity of the military action and so forth. Hezbollah is back, the resistance is back, and South Lebanon is becoming once more an important factor in all of this. And again, as the professor said from Bir Zeit, the rise of the Lion's Den and other brigades, whether in Jenin, in Jericho, in Bethlehem, in Al-Khalil as well, and other places, means that the Palestinian resistance in the West Bank has managed to liberate itself not only from the Israeli military control, but also from the confines and limits imposed on it by the Palestinian Authority for many years. Okay. And now you have this whole new paradigm and so many new actors. And Israel, simply considering all of this, cannot win the way it used to win in.
There was, obviously, you're well aware there, Syed Nimer, about the visit of the Iranian president to Syria. And while he was addressing some of the resistance groups there and their leaders, from the Islamic Jihad to Hamas, one of the interesting points that I picked up that I'd like to get your reaction is that he has said the Israeli regime has effortlessly tried to make Palestinians believe that their fate actually lied in the hands of the occupiers. But the notion is far from the truth, because Palestinian fighters, he said, are the ones who have the upper hand on the ground. Our guest there in Seattle, Ramzi Baroud, mentioned the Lion's Den. Tell us what you think about the role that the Lion's Den is becoming, is increasingly playing, because it's more colorful when it comes to what is happening on the ground and the way that it's actually retaliating against the regime forces.
Yes, as I said, I think we are on the verge of the big, battle, the end of, because of this alliance and because of other factors in the region. First of all, we have to understand that the role of America in the Middle East started to get weaker and weaker. And it's a fact, not only in the Middle East, but it was clear also even in the Ukrainian-Russian war, where even the Americans are pushing the Europeans rather than doing anything themselves. So the American role is now in a decline issue, especially in the Middle East. And that, you know, was clear when Saudi Arabia now is closer to Iran, and they are now normalizing the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and so other other, Gulf states. It means that now we are accepting Iran. Just last year, it was the other way around. They were running to be in alliance with Israel against Iran in a way or another. Now it's the other way around. So these are new facts on the ground, because everyone is realizing now that the American role is getting weaker and weaker in the Middle East, and that will be for the benefit of the alliance of the resistance in general. And I mentioned also Yemen also. Yeah, we are talking about Yemen, Iran, Syria, and Lebanon, and also to a certain degree Iraq. So all those, in addition to the Palestinian resistance, whether it's in Gaza or in the West Bank, so we are now reaching the limit of the end, if you like, of this stupid project, which started like 75 years ago, a Zionist project, colonialist project based on hatred, violence, and racism. It's going to be ended definitely. And all the accounts, if you like, around us, and the indications in the region indicates that, yes, we are on the right path. We need now for the Palestinian resistance in the West Bank to be stronger and more even resisting. Also, we need a unification in all of the on the ground, not necessarily by Palestinian Authority and Hamas or whatever we are talking about, but we are talking about the field unity for all Palestinian resistors in order to defeat this project once and for all.
So the news of Iran and Saudi Arabia reconciling was big news, Ramzi Baroud. I mean, a lot of people were actually very shocked. Many entertained it. The CIA chief said that the U.S. was blindsided, but that really was a tectonic shift in the region. Put it into context for us, when you have that on the one hand, on the other hand, you have Syria that's being invited back into the fold, and then you have the news that has happened in the past couple of weeks, which is quite, in a sense, unbelievable, and that is the fact that Saudi Arabia actually received a Hamas delegation recently in order to see how it can mend ties. And just in the past days, Saudi Arabia said that it is also interested in reconciling with Hezbollah. I mean, I'm wondering what Israel thinks about all this happening at this point in time.
It really is incredible. I mean, just a couple of years ago, we were under the impression, well, some of us were not, but many were under the impression that the history was moving into a single direction and there was no other possibility. Jared Kushner and his company, were pushing, the Abraham Accords, more and more Arab countries start joining. We Palestinians were just basically scratching our head, what has happened? And yet the moment you feel like this, the fate of Palestine, as far as relationship with its Arab environs and of its Middle Eastern and Muslim environs were concerned, as soon as we felt that was over, it somehow a whole new historical direction was recreated by circumstances partly completely outside the control of anybody in the region. And I'm talking here specifically about the Russia-Ukraine war, the new global competition, the geopolitical turf war going on between the West and its China, Russia, and others, the rise of nations like the rise of new entities like the BRICS nations and others, and suddenly that opened up new breathing room, new spaces for countries. Even beyond the Middle East, if you look at even Burkina Faso, Mali, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Venezuela, and others are now finding more space to operate politically and to challenge their former colonial powers, France, Germany, the United States, Britain, and others. The Middle East was not the exception. Thank God for that. They were not the exceptions, and they found that there are new margins and new opportunities. And to their credit, they seized on these historic opportunities. And it really is something that is fundamentally different from what any of us had expected, to seeing Iran with the Saudis joining forces at, yes, taking the first steps in creating a new type of political political platform in the region that challenges the American-led Israeli-led regional platforms, and to see all of these possibilities just being ignited all at once. I can't even tell you and emphasize how empowering all of this is for the Palestinian people. Instead of feeling isolated and marginalized, sure, suddenly we are back at the center of the story.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, we can detect that in the tone of your voice there, Saad Nimr, in terms of the optimism that you have, because obviously, based on previous interviews, the show of confidence in your outlook there is more visible now as opposed to before. And that's great, really. But what do you think about the fact that you have now Israel to be now completely alienated? Because when you have this reconciliation that has happened between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and with the somewhat of a warm approach that Saudi Arabia has had towards Hamas and Hezbollah, Israel needs to then, is the sole entity now, needs to rethink its approach when it comes to Palestinians. That's, however, a far cry. How do you see Israel reacting to all of this?
No, Israel is an arrogant regime, and they will continue to be arrogant regime, especially with this kind of alliances within the government lately. Religious Zionist, Smotrich, Ben-Gvir, and Netanyahu's government is not going to even to think in this issue in a positive way, if we are going to think about it. But we have to understand something else, that Israel is at weakest point now. I'm talking about not only the government, but I'm talking also about the Israeli society. They are not willing nor ready for a war, and especially if any war comes, and it would be a little bit more or longer than 1 month, this Israeli society will collapse. They are not prepared, they don't want to, and they are not ready for such thing. As they call it, the internal front in Israel is really in a mess now, especially with all these atrocities and problems that they have in the Israeli society, and the no matching and the nature. The Israeli regime, of its nature as a racist regime, even against the Jews of Israel itself, whether they are differentiating between the Shiknazim and the Sephardim, or even the blacks, Ethiopian Jewish blacks. And I'm talking about Jews who are in the same country, but they are not in the same boat in a way or another. So I think that now they reached this moment where Israel is in its weakest point. But for the government and how they are going to react, they are so stupid that they're going to say violence and more violence, because that's what they can, you know, offer. They can't offer anything, neither to the Palestinians or to the region, apart from, you know, violence.
And I'd like to end it on something that maybe is somewhat on the sideline, and it shouldn't be, and that is the siege that Israel has on the Gaza Strip, Ramzi Berub. This point needs to be highlighted because it's been going on for quite some time. Over 16 years at this point in a row, and the Palestinians are suffering. Needless to say that consequentially, that obviously is a threat to Israel in one way or another when you have so many Palestinians suffering as a result. Do you think that we can see anything coming out of the approach that Israel uses on the Gaza Strip?
Well, the idea behind the siege initially was, as articulated by the Israelis themselves, is to create this kind of two examples, two models. One of Palestinians who are suffering, lacking clean water, lacking food, lacking life-saving medications in Gaza, and those who are being somewhat propped up and living slightly better life in a different market.